I know some folks may look at this and say, this is a way of politely killing the bill. That's not my intention at all. That's not the intention of leadership.
A controversial school choice amendment fails to make it to the Senate floor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 12th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, health clinics brace for cuts to a program that helps them recruit doctors.
He literally said, we are the safety net. And all I can say is if this passes, there's going to be a big hole in that safety net.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Over the past two legislative sessions, conservative lawmakers have prioritized an amendment that would allow public money to be spent at private schools. Today was supposed to be the grand showdown where the state Senate would take a vote on it. The measure did not even make it to the floor. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that the bill was pulled because it did not have enough support to pass.
For the past few days, staffers, reporters, and lawmakers alike have made a pastime of counting the votes for Senate Joint Resolution 9. It's rare that legislation will go on the floor calendar unless it's guaranteed to pass. But as an amendment to the Alaska Constitution, SJR 9 needs two-thirds approval to go forward, and a sizable contingent of Democrats and moderate Republicans have vocally opposed it. As many suspected, the support was just not there. After delaying the floor session Wednesday for a couple hours to talk strategy, leadership announced they would hold the bill in the legislative limbo that is the Senate Rules Committee instead of bringing it out for a vote. Senator Mike Dunleavy, a MATSU Republican who is sponsoring the bill, says that does not mean the bill is dead.
I know some folks may look at this and say, this is a way of politely killing the bill. That's not my intention at all. That's not the intention of leadership. It's, again, just getting some additional information and having some additional discussions with folks this week.
Dunleavy says he wants information on the legality of education programs the state is already offering, like the Alaska Performance Scholarship. But he would not elaborate any more on that information, except to say he thinks it could turn a couple votes. Dunleavy adds he wants to see the amendment back on the Senate schedule as soon as possible, and he thinks there's value in having a floor debate, even if there's not certainty a measure will pass.
You want to be careful that there's not a gaming of the system where all the decisions are made off the floor. There should be floor debates, there should be floor votes, and there'll be votes that pass and there'll be votes that fail.
Senator Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican who has been a firm opponent of the measure, says it's going to be an uphill battle for those who want it to pass. While the amendment may not be technically dead, it's arguably comatose.
Clearly, they didn't have the votes. They needed 14 votes. And I've talked to several members of the, you know, of the caucus who also opposed to it. And, you know, I think at least five members of our 15-member caucus are very much opposed to it.
Stevens says pulling SJR 9 allows Senate leadership to keep the measure alive and save a little bit of face. Like Dunleavy, he would not have minded having a discussion on the floor about what the measure means for the state. While Dunleavy argues that SJR 9 could expand options for students and their parents, Stevens is worried it would lead to an expensive voucher system and drain resources from public schools. He was prepared to speak to that on Wednesday.
The debate is good, and we should do that more. You know, I think there's sort of a tendency, though, on the part of a majority caucus not to want to put something on the floor and have it fail. It's sort of a sign of weakness, and very seldom does that happen in this body. Very seldom do you see either the House or the Senate put something on the floor when they know it's going to fail.
Out of more than 1,000 bills introduced since 2011, only three pieces of legislation have failed on the floor, according to data compiled by Gavel Alaska. A companion to SJR 9 has also been introduced in the House, but it has yet to come to a vote in that chamber. Any amendment to the Alaska Constitution needs two-thirds approval from both chambers of the legislature and then support from a majority of registered voters in the state. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Senator Lisa Murkowski today pressed the Secretary of Homeland Security to make the Arctic a priority for the administration, particularly for the Coast Guard. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, she got no disagreement.
Homeland Security is the Swiss Army knife of government departments. It has a huge range of duties. So when its $38 billion budget request came before a Senate panel today, Secretary Jay Johnson heard a wide range of pleas. Senators emphasized the need to protect the border, encourage trade, and improve disaster response. For Senator Murkowski, it's all about the Arctic. With ocean travel increasing, Murkowski told Johnson the world is looking to the United States for leadership in the region.
Whether it's cruise ships coming up over the top, whether it's container vessels going through the Bering Straits, the level of activity that we're seeing there is unprecedented, and how we handle that is going to be key going forward.
Someday, Murkowski told him, his department may have to contend with German tourists coming ashore at Barrow. She says the Coast Guard, also part of Homeland Security, should have more icebreakers. It has only three, and one is in dry dock. Murkowski also asked him to consider homeporting one of the Coast Guard's national security ships in Kodiak, because the nearest now is in California.
I'm told that it's 24 days to get a national security cutter from Alameda up to the Chukchi Beaufort Sea area. That's a long way to be underway when we have an incident that would require that level of a vessel up there.
Johnson said what he told every senator. He agrees with them. He says the Arctic is a priority to the administration.
I believe, first and foremost, that our priorities in the Arctic surround increasing commerce there.
He says replacing the older of the heavy icebreakers, the Polar Star, is still in the long-term acquisition plan. Johnson says no decision has yet been made about the Polar Sea, the icebreaker not in service.
But overall, I do recognize the importance of having heavy icebreakers.
Across the Capitol, the head of the Coast Guard faced criticism from a House panel today over its $10 billion portion of the Homeland Security budget request. Some members said it was wasteful. Others said the amount dedicated to modernizing the fleet is inadequate. At the Senate hearing, though, the focus was on each senator's home state priorities. After Murkowski talked about the Arctic, it was Kansas Senator Jerry Moran's turn to discuss his top goal for the department, safeguarding agriculture. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating Shakespeare with a bardathon in Juneau.
If the skin were parchment and the blows you gave were ink, your own handwriting would tell you what I think.
I think thou art an ass.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A State House committee has eliminated funding for a state program that helps medical professionals repay their student loans if they serve poor or rural patients. It's called the Sharp 2 program, and clinics say it's an essential tool to convince physicians and other medical professionals to care for patients in underserved communities. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Kim Cohen has a tough time recruiting physicians. As executive director at the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, the pay she's able to offer her doctors is limited. They can earn about 50% more in the private sector.
A lot of people that want to help the poor and want to go into community health have large student loans. And so one of the things we can offer them apart from we can't give them a high salary, is we can help them pay off their student loans through this program.
A House Finance Subcommittee cut $1.2 million for the program, eliminating next year's funding. If the cut goes through, a doctor at Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, who was just approved for the program, would lose his spot, along with 38 others who were supposed to start receiving loan repayment. Representative Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake, is responsible for the cut. He says it wasn't an easy decision, but the budget needed trimming.
The Health and Social Services is a difficult budget, you know, and when you get into years where you just don't have money coming in to cover your costs, you're forced to do reductions.
Newman says he felt better about eliminating funding for a few programs like SHARP than making small trims to many more. And he says SHARP was a more appealing target than funding that would go to serve seniors or foster kids.
I think I read some notes here that the average practitioner was getting almost $30,000 a year. That's almost a lot of people's yearly salary. And I know that, you know, again, when you have to start reducing budgets, where do you start? I mean, none of them are easy. They're all good programs. We'd like to support them all, but the state just does not have the money.
And Newman points out providers will still be eligible for the SHARP 1 program, which also repays loans and is partly funded by the federal government. But Tom Chard, who's executive director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, says the federal program is not meeting the needs of Alaska. Chard is on the committee that decides which medical professionals can participate in the program.
We as a state said, look, we think that we can design parameters to better meet our outcomes here in state than the feds can, and we're willing to put a little bit of money in to match that.
The federal SHARP program is limited to providers working in rural areas of Alaska. Chard says the state program recognizes urban areas are also struggling to attract medical professionals to work with low-income patients. Chard thinks the program is a bargain.
$1.2 million, the proposed reduction amount, is a lot of money, but we're going to actually save a ton of money through putting positions into these places that are otherwise very hard to fill, very hard to recruit for, otherwise would go vacant or be filled by a temporary position.
It costs clinics a lot more to hire temporary or fill-in doctors to see patients. At the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, Kim Cohen says she feels like she's been sucker punched. When Governor Parnell declined federal funding for Medicaid expansion, he said clinics like Cohen's would be able to provide a safety net for patients who would not be eligible for Medicaid.
First, they don't expand Medicaid. And that's hard enough because 42% of my population at the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center do not have insurance. And so I don't have the funding there trying to operate a center. And now they're taking away my ability to help pay for my physicians by repaying their student loans. And so now I'm like, how are we supposed to be the safety net of the community if we don't have doctors to provide for the patients that we're supposed to be seeing?
Parnell kept the SHARP 2 funding in his version of the operating budget. The Senate could restore funding for the program when it begins work on the budget. If that happens, the House and Senate would work out their differences in conference committee. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Affordable Care Act is a big law with plenty of ripple effects, but at its heart is a pretty simple premise. Americans who lack health insurance should be able to go online and pick a plan, and if their income falls beneath a certain threshold, then the federal government will cover part of the cost. That is, unless you live in Alaska or one of the other states that has opted out of the federal Medicaid expansion. Then you can actually make too little money to qualify for help. This is what some are calling the Medicaid donut hole. And as KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports, falling into the donut hole can be a frustrating experience.
One night in early March, Wayne and Sarah Taranoff walked into a room at the University of Alaska Southeast for an open enrollment session on the Affordable Care Act. They didn't come with high hopes.
Basically, just to see what the options were. I didn't think there would be any, and there wasn't.
And why was that?
Because we're in the bracket that got screwed.
We make too little.
Too little.
And they didn't expand the Medicaid.
The Taranoffs are self-employed.
We have our own business. A little gift store downtown.
And they haven't had health insurance in decades. Wayne Taranoff has diabetes. One year, he said, they spent about 60% of their income on medical bills. But their gift shop doesn't bring in much money. If they tried to buy health insurance on their own, it would cost...
more than we make.
We only make about...
well, about $8,000
a year. About $8,000 a year. The store only makes enough to pay its electricity and its...
if we were open more,
phone bills
might do
and
better,
stuff.
But...
under the Affordable Care Act, anyone who earns up to four times the federal poverty limit is eligible for tax credits and subsidies that cover the cost of insurance bought on the exchanges. In Alaska, that means an individual who makes more than about $14,500 and less than about $58,000 is likely eligible for some kind of help. But people like the Taranoffs, who make less than $14,000 a year, can't get subsidies. That's because when the law was originally written, everyone under the federal poverty limit was supposed to be covered by an expansion of Medicaid. In 2012, the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act in a landmark ruling, but they ruled the federal government couldn't force states to expand Medicaid. And in Alaska,
I believe a costly Medicaid expansion, especially on top of the broken Obamacare system, is a hot mess.
That's Governor Sean Parnell in November 2013 announcing that Alaska would not expand Medicaid. The way expansion was supposed to work is this. States would expand the pool of people eligible for Medicaid, covering not just families with kids and people with disabilities, but also low-income adults who don't have kids at home, like the Taranoffs. The federal government would cover the full cost of the expansion for the first 3 years and at least 90% of the cost after that. But Parnell argued that the federal government couldn't be trusted to keep its end of the bargain.
The decision comes down to this. Can states trust the federal government to not cut and run on its share of the cost?
Are you angry about that?
Yeah. I mean, I mixed emotions. I was totally against the health care thing the way they were doing it. And so in a way,
the Taranoffs said that they actually find the whole Affordable Care Act disappointing. They would have preferred a single-payer system like the one that Canada has. The idea of being forced to buy insurance bothers them.
We're being forced to pay private insurance companies.
Not us. We don't make enough.
The Taranoffs won't be forced to pay any penalty for remaining without insurance. They can fill out a hardship waiver. They'll simply remain as they were, uninsured and shouldering the cost of medical bills themselves. According to a state-funded study, about 43,000 Alaskans fall into the same category as the Taranoffs. Of those, about 17,000 are Alaska Native and qualify for tribal health benefits. The rest, if they want health coverage, will have to pay full cost.
This is going to give you the least out-of-pocket and the lowest deductible.
Meanwhile, at the enrollment event in Sitka, organizers estimated that out of the 25 or so people who came in to get help finding health insurance, 7 left empty-handed. They, too, fell into the Medicaid donut hole. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
The Fairbanks City Council passed a resolution Monday in support of state, federal, and international monitoring for radiation from the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. Reactors at the facility were damaged during the major earthquake in Japan 3 years ago this week, and there's concern about continued long-range radiation. Fairbanks Borough Assemblymember John Davies testified in support of the resolution. He said he has no evidence that there's currently a problem with radiation impacts in Alaska, but that monitoring is warranted.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The statewide halibut and black cod season opened last Saturday. When YK Delta fishermen participate in the community development quota allocations this summer, they will see their halibut quota cut nearly in half. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Dawson Hoover is the Communication and Community Benefits Manager for Coastal Villages Region Fund.
And it's devastating for a lot of fishermen. And then we have 184-plus boats that crewed about a couple of people in each boat, and for for a lot of these people, it's their main source of income for the year. And these cuts are devastating for our residents who need to pay for their bills to sustain their families.
The 2014 quota stands for coastal villages at 107,000 pounds. That's the biggest cut among the CDQ groups and accounts for a 48% drop over last year. The International Pacific Halibut Commission finalized those quotas in January. CVRF proposed doubling the CDQ's quota, which last year was some 210,000 pounds. It took less than 2 weeks to catch that entire quota. Hoover says it may take only a week this year. CVRF wants a review of the science that exists on nearby halibut stocks.
We know that there aren't any studies, any recent studies done in the areas that we fish in, but the word of mouth is from our fishermen is that towards the end of the commercial fishing season that we opened last year, they were catching bigger halibut. You know, the girth was bigger. And because there aren't any studies done because of the bigger fish that they were catching, we believe that, you know, we shouldn't have gotten these big cuts.
Hoover says he does not anticipate any changes in the 2014 quotas. Statewide, the total allowable catch for halibut is set at 16.8 million pounds. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska legislature could join the chorus of voices calling for an American Indian Veterans Memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. An Alaska Senate committee on Tuesday passed a resolution supporting the project. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Native Americans have fought in every United States military conflict since the Revolutionary War and have some of the highest per capita service rates of any ethnic group. Since Alaska became a U.S. territory and later a state, Alaska Natives have served their country as well. During World War II, the Alaska Territorial Guard included more than 6,000 volunteer soldiers from more than 100 communities. Kalissa Maley is an intern in the office of Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat.
American Indians have established a long and distinguished legacy of military service. Senate Joint Resolution 19 affirms the Alaska State Legislature's support of Alaska Native and Native American veterans and recognizes their great sacrifices for our country.
Willikowski sponsored SJR 19, which passed out of the Senate State Affairs Committee Tuesday. He says the American Indian Veterans Memorial is sponsored by the Alaska Federation of Natives, the National Congress of American Indians, and Vietnam Veterans of America, among other groups.
There was several people that came up from Florida to attend AFN and push for this resolution. I attended the Vietnam Veterans of America National Conference in Florida last year, and they were there. I spoke with people there. They were urging us to do this as well.
In 1994, Congress approved the Native American Veterans Memorial Act, but the project didn't go anywhere. Stephen Bowers, a member of the Seminole Tribe of Florida and a Vietnam vet, started lobbying Native American groups to support the memorial in 2011. He says it's long overdue.
It'll mean that finally someone's recognizing the fact that the American Indians fought for this country and against the European invaders back since 1492.
While Bowers says many supporters want the memorial to be built near the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, President Obama late last year signed legislation to place it at the National Museum of the American Indian, 2 miles away. Bowers says the location isn't as important as getting a memorial concept approved, a process he says will take several years.
When they built the National Mall, they didn't make it easy for organizations or for anyone to put a statue or a memorial on the mall.
Bowers expects the National Museum of the American Indian to sponsor a contest and form a committee to shepherd the project through the design phase. Senate Joint Resolution 19 now heads to a vote on the floor of the Alaska Senate. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
If he were alive today, William Shakespeare would be 450 years old in April. In honor of the event, the capital city is celebrating with its first Bardathon, 24 hours of Shakespeare readings for 8 consecutive days. The nonstop Shakespeare kicked off on Saturday. KTOO's Lisa Fu stopped by Juneau's downtown public library on day 4 of the Bardathon.
Cale Burnham is missing school at Montessori Borealis to play the part of Luciana in Act 2 of the Comedy of Errors.
Dromio, thou snail, thou slug, thou sot!
Four other people are reading the play with Cale and three more at the Alaska State Museum are participating through video conference.
Shall I be porter at the gate?
Aye, and let none enter lest I break your pate.
Librarian Amelia Jenkins is facilitating the reading, so she's in charge of organizing the parts.
Would you like to be Jeromeo of Ephesus?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Balthazar?
Danny, you want to be Balthazar?
Sure, I'll be Balthazar.
For Act 3, 10-year-old Kale reads the part of Jeromeo of Ephesus, a servant to Antipholus of Ephesus, a well-respected merchant, played by 63-year-old Bruce Rogers of Fairbanks.
Thou drunkard, thou, what didst thou mean by this?
Say what you will, sir, but I know what I know, that you beat me at the mart, I have your hand to show. If the skin were parchment, and the blows you gave were ink, your own handwriting would tell you what I think.
I think thou art an ass.
Kale is with his mother, but it was his idea to participate in the Bardathon. His interest in Shakespeare stems from reading the children's book series, Alvin Ho.
He was throwing Shakespearean insults out, and this was one of them. It was, "Be gone, ye be shivering, onion-eyed flap dragon." It's funny.
Bruce Rogers is artistic director of the Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater, which is getting ready to perform its 15th Bardathon in April. He's been facilitating middle-of-the-night sessions at Perseverance Theater, reading the historical Henry VI, Part 1, 2, and 3.
Nothing else to do when you're up that late. Have another cup of coffee and read a little Shakespeare.
Juno organizer Beth Weigel says the Bardathon is a way for Shakespeare amateurs to begin understanding the literature.
If you're at home trying to read it silently, sometimes it doesn't make sense. It makes more sense when you've got different voices reading and you hear the words and you can get a little bit of the jokes that come in and out.
Along with 39 plays, 100 Shakespeare sonnets will be read 8 a.m. Friday morning at the Douglas Library. Hamlet marks the finale of Juno's Bardathon, which is getting statewide attention. Nome's Public Library plans to participate through video conference. In Juno, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The University of Alaska Southeast offers degree programs you won't find anywhere else, like the customizable BLA, online or on campus. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.